Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else fill up the wall with our English dead.
Welcome back. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. We're back a little bit early this hour. We're going to be talking again more on lots of subjects that have happened this week in the economy. And we'll probably get in, you know, we talk about the savings rate and so on. I think we're likely to get into some of the personal financial planning type issues. Rather, we've covered the macro really, really well. We've got some more macro stuff to cover in that this week. President Biden met with a couple of people in his office. Did you read about that?
Yes, several different. Which one are you referring to?
Dr. Powell and Dr. Brainard separately. So what are we talking about here?
Job interviews.
Yeah, it's November at a point 6 years after the current chair of the Federal Reserve was approved. So his term ends early next year. It expires in January.
Chairman Powell's term ends, not the president's term.
Not the president's term, yes. So I think actually it goes through March. Well, I don't know why I said January. It goes through March, but he has to be, whoever's going into that role, has to be approved by the Senate. And if you have watched what's happened in Congress over the past several months, you realize that they have a different kind of time in that building. Sometimes they compact a bunch of time into a very short period, and other times they stretch out very short things into extremely long. So he met with two people this week, Chairman Powell, who we have good things to say about. We think he's done a fantastic job as chair of the Federal Reserve. But also, he had a separate meeting with Fed Governor Lael Brainard, who's also a doctor, an economist. She went to Harvard and is a professor of economics at MIT Sloan School of Business. Now, I get some of my continuing education through MIT's Sloan School, so I have to say that I've spoken to her multiple times, and she's brilliant. So I don't know if this is just the time that we live in, but both of these two people that are kind of the top of the list. Anyway, Lael Brainard is brilliant. Jerome Powell is brilliant. So we live in a time where it looks like the two potential candidates are about as good as you can get.
So, I would say, though, that removing Chairman Powell at this point would be a shock.
Yeah, it would.
It would be a very, very bad thing to do.
I agree.
The markets have a lot of confidence in Chairman Powell. He's done an exceptionally good job. And to suddenly remove him and replace him with somebody that, and be frankly, the progressives want her in there,
right,
to be an activist.
So, this is the thing. There's another vacancy popping up on the board. There's another vacancy. The vice chairman, Richard Clarida, is ending his term in January. This is the peak of excitement in the music here. Okay, it's coming down. Thank you. Fed vice chairman Clarida, his term expires in January. So it looks like
he stays on the board.
He'll stay on the board, but they need a new vice chairman. So
somebody in charge of vice.
Yes, all the vices of the Federal Reserve. But the vice chairman is appointed by the president and approved by the Senate as well. So I suspect that Jerome Powell is going to be the next chairman, and I suspect that Lael Brainard is going to be the next vice chairman. Janet Yellen was vice chairman before she was chairman, and this is a very normal kind of buildup. This is who we think is going to be next. So as boring as the Biden administration is, they're at least sending out the signals that the people that watch this stuff know how to read, to say he is kind of quietly announcing that he thinks it's going to be Powell as chairman and Brainard as vice chairman. The market hasn't reacted to that. No blips or anything. There was some pretty good coverage on it in the Wall Street Journal. And what that means is that everything around the Federal Reserve needs lots of communication about events that happen in the future Because the worst case scenario is the market is surprised by something at the Federal Reserve. I cannot remember a time when there's been a good reaction to a surprise at the Federal Reserve from the market. Even good surprises tend to lead to bad reactions from the market at the Federal Reserve because everybody wants to not be surprised there. We want to know what's going to happen in the future and who's in charge, who's making the decisions, and how long that's going to be. So that's all good news, in my opinion. And I think I've covered the meeting at the White House now enough for these two positions. I think that's as much of the tea leaves as we could read, but it looks like Powell is likely to stay as chairman, and it looks like Brainard may be vice chairman, which is both of those positions. I can't think of anybody who'd be better for the job right now.
All right. Can we talk about, I want to talk about Neil Gallagher for a minute.
Let's do it.
Neil Gallagher, who had a radio show on Christian radio station out of Dallas for years, called himself the money doctor, called himself Doc Gallagher, and his organization, he had an interesting organization, the Neil Gallagher organization had the term PhD in it, so it sounded like he had a PhD, which, by the way, he didn't. And interestingly, he spent years.
It sounded like he had a PhD. He went by the nickname Doc, and PhD right. was in the name of the company.
Right. He went for years on the radio in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, where the SEC has an office, by the way, proclaiming his wisdom and his experience, and that he was going to provide Christian guidance. And he published a couple of books, whether he actually wrote them or not, that focused on Christianity and investing. And people gave him a lot of money. So how do you avoid this type of thing happening? Well, for starters, William Neil Gallagher was never registered with the SEC or the state of Texas as an investment advisor, nor was his company registered as an investment advisor. So the first thing you do if you are working with somebody who claims to want to advise you on investing, get their name, get the name of their company, and go to the SEC website, which will direct you to another website, and check them out and see if they're registered. Very simple process. But you do need to do that process. He was never registered anywhere. He was never an investment advisor. And if a person is giving you investment advice and you're paying them, you're giving them money and they're taking money to do it, by law, they have to be registered as an investment advisor or an investment advisor representative.
Yeah. So this is where we're kind of nitty gritty on this. The SEC charged him in 2019 and said, hey, you got to shut down. The state found him guilty and charged him money and sentenced him to 25 years. And now the federal government has done the same, found him guilty and given him life in prison. And the SEC says this, it's a classic Ponzi scheme. What he promised. He promised his investors 5-8% a year. And he would be investing in a stable retirement fund, but he didn't really specify that. Instead, he deposited all the investors' money into one account. Everybody's money went into one account that he controlled and used to make payments to the early investors. That's pure Ponzi there. That is exactly what a Ponzi is.
He was making up statements issued by his organization. They were fake, showing where the investments were supposedly held, but they weren't. Here's the second thing I think that's very important. If you are working with somebody who's part of some organization and they're giving you investment advice, are you receiving statements from somebody else?
Are you receiving audited statements?
Are you receiving a statement from a major firm that's recognizable? And if you contact that firm where the statement is supposedly coming from, and by the way, if you get the statement in the mail, it should be coming from there, but many times we get them by website or email now, so that's a little harder. And it's just sensible, contact the custodian, whoever the custodian is, And the custodian should not be the person who's giving you investment advice. So this is a hard one.
I have to make a correction here real quick. He went as Doc Gallagher and the Money Doctor. He had a PhD in philosophy.
He did?
Yes. So okay. He did have a PhD, but it had nothing to do with money. It had to do with philosophy.
I won't go into that one. Anyway, your money is someplace being held by a custodian. And in our opinion, this is just our opinion, it's not rock solid. The person who is investing the money for you should not be the custodian. That leaves yourself wide open to being involved in a Ponzi scheme. If there is a well-known, well-established firm that you can find references to and it's out there, and you contact them and say, is my money there? Do you have my investments? Whoever sends you a statement, do you have my investments? And you recognize that firm, they're a member of the New York Stock Exchange, for example, which they should be, then you're probably at least not in a Ponzi scheme. But it's really important that you not just passively say, this guy talks a good talk. He's spoken at our church.
He's a Christian.
He's a Christian. He's got a radio show. Therefore, let's give him the money. And as long as the money comes in, we're happy. There are a lot of people, many, many, many people, over 100, probably around, I think he said 190, who have lost, in some cases, everything they have. They've lost all their savings. They've lost all their retirement income. They've lost everything, and they won't get back very much of it at all.
Yeah, there were a series of people testifying in the sentencing part of this. And by the way, it was 3 life sentences for an 80-year-old. I don't know how long that's going to be. I don't think he's got 3 lives left. But at court, dozens of victims testified, describing how they were forced to sell their house, to borrow money from their children, take part-time jobs to supplement their Social Security, because he took all their money.
And he gets worse. A lot of the people who he gave money to are now going to have to cough that. In other words, the people, the early investors that he started, who actually probably have seen a profit over the years, are going to have to return that money to the trustee appointed by the court, or they get sued.
Yeah, and this is Court Thomas is the guy in charge of that, and he's estimating $23 million in losses, and he's returned $3.3 million so far. But that comes from clawing it back from people who got it as pay that they thought was theirs. And this has happened over decades. Receiving stolen property, even if you don't know it's stolen, it still doesn't belong to you. And this is something that we talked about when Bernie Madoff was in the headlines. It's something that we talk about now. What you said before, making sure that you have a statement from a third party saying that you actually have the value that the person tells you you have is vital. And you and I have both run into this many times in our career. People come in with statements and say, I want to take a look at these investments. And then I look at the statement, and it's not a statement, and it's got typos all over it, and it was printed out from the office of the person who invested it there. And I say, do you have anything else that shows that you have money somewhere? And they say, no, but he's a trustworthy guy, and that's always where it goes. And in all of that, I've seen this how many times? Maybe 5 times in my career, I've seen something as blatant as this, but on a much smaller scale. And unfortunately, most of these cases don't get prosecuted. So they stay out there. Person just says, I want my money back. Let me go. And the person scrambles to do it and can't do it. And then an attorney says, give us the money back or we're going to sue you. And so they find the money somehow, but they've got, you know, hundreds of other clients that don't know that money is not available.
And then there's the case where you try to get your money back from somebody who's misappropriated your money and they're bankrupt.
That's right.
And there's nothing you can do about it. And believe me, unless it's a big case like this one was with many millions of dollars, the SEC just doesn't get around to prosecuting. They're out there. And there's some, As a matter of fact, I know of people who have done that type of, who've basically taken money from their clients and they're still in business doing investment advice someplace.
Yeah.
It's crucial that not only you get a statement, but that the statement come from a well-known third party, not some off the wall someplace that looks like it's important but isn't. And
look
that you
up.
Call there and say, do you have these investments for me? You actually contact them at some point. As part of a standard audit that's done on any organization once a year, one of the key things that's done is contacting the bank or the custodian or whoever supposedly is holding the money for the organization and say, is it there? And people generally tend not to do that. They say, well, I don't understand that. Well, understand it. If it isn't a bank or a New York Stock Exchange member that's sending you the statement, there's a fairly good chance that the money may not be there. And that's just, and these things go on for years and years and years, and people lose tremendous amounts of money. And I don't even remember the number of times this has happened over the years that people have come in and they've lost tremendous amounts of money. We look at it and say, this is fake. And they have a lot of trouble believing it. And it doesn't make the headlines because the person who was doing it never got prosecuted.
Right.
So beware. Exactly.
And yeah, so I think we've hit that one. We've got another kind of big news item. The infrastructure bill finally passed. We've been talking about this for over a year now as it's been built because Donald Trump was trying to build it at the end of his term. And then Joe Biden picked it up at the beginning of his. And it's gone from, under the Trump administration, a $3.8 trillion bill for infrastructure, new infrastructure, to when Joe Biden stepped in, it was for $2.2 trillion. It's now been trimmed down to the net new spending in the bill is around half a trillion.
$500 billion. $550-ish.
Yeah. New money. So, and this is something we were talking about before the program about, I asked you how many different price tags you had found for the infrastructure bill. And I see three completely different numbers quoted at different places. The Guardian was saying 1.2 trillion. No, that was Fox News that said 1.2 trillion. The Guardian said 555 million and the Wall Street Journal said 1 trillion. When you break it all down, it's $555 billion of new spending on roads and infrastructure and so on.
Over and some other stuff. Over a five-year period.
That's right.
So it's roughly $200 billion a year over the next 5 years. And I don't want to denigrate $200 billion, but in light of the total budget, it is a pretty small amount of money. And this is important. It's critical that we get this infrastructure bill passed. It's critical that we put it into effect.
Right.
That we get it in effect and we start fixing bridges and internet and roads and all the other things in our infrastructure that need to be fixed and need to be expanded. That's what will keep us going. Without it, we won't keep going.
Now, on the same day, the House passed the $2 trillion education, healthcare, climate package. That's really the budget. All that other stuff added into it is just labeling stuff on the budget. Don't get too upset yet about what's in that bill. That's not a final bill. It's got to go to the Senate now. They're going to pass their own version of it. And then they're going to go to conference and make a Frankenstein out of whatever was passed in the Senate and the House. So we really still don't know what's in that bill. What we know is in the infrastructure bill. And there's a lot of stuff for roads and bridges. There's stuff for broadband in there. There's a lot of other cool little features in there that look like a different form of infrastructure than most people are used to. So people will go back to the conservative, extremely conservative view of that infrastructure is only roads. And they get upset when broadband is brought up. But that is we actually, in the early 90s, when they were talking about this new interweb, it was called the Information Superhighway. It really is. That's where a lot of the business is. I mean, a vast amount of business goes through broadband. So calling it infrastructure simply makes sense. It is a physical thing that needs to be laid out in a lot of cases, and it makes sense.
There's word going around, and I find it to be fundamentally inaccurate, that only a minority of this bill is going to the infrastructure. That's not true.
Yeah.
The breakdown includes 621 others of the total of both bills, both sides of the bill, extending existing infrastructure, which, by the way, largely were passed under the Republicans, and adding another $550 billion to it. $621 billion for transportation, $400 billion for home care services, $300 billion for manufacturing, and $180 billion for research and development. Now, there's also $85 billion to modernize public transit, $80 billion for Amtrak, $50 billion to safeguard critical infrastructure, and $20 billion to improve road safety. There are emails floating around saying that that is an infrastructure. Well, it is.
And if you just, and by the emails floating around, by the way, I got one from Representative John Carter. I got one this morning for immediate release. And it talks about 25% of the total funding of this will actually go to infrastructure. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to hammer on John Carter. He's the local United States federal representative. He represents District 31 in Texas. And we've had him on the program lots of times, way, way back in the past when he was first running for office. And we're on pretty good terms with him.
I think.
Back in August, the Senate passed this bill in a bipartisan way. It was a 69-30 vote. A lot of Democrats, a lot of Republicans supported it. Democrats and Republicans opposed it. You couldn't really find a party line for the vote. But because it was used as a bargaining chip to say, we won't pass this unless the other big spending bill gets passed, it was used by Nancy Pelosi against the progressives in her party, which caused the conservatives in the Republican Party to suddenly look at a bill that passed totally bipartisan, which a few months ago, John Carter was saying, this is a great thing and we need to get it passed. It hasn't changed since then. It's the same bill. But because it was being used as a political bargaining chip, there's a different vocalization from the Republicans on what the bill is. If you just read the news from the Republicans and then in August, you'll get the true story. Don't read the stuff from the Democrats today about it either, because the progressives are talking about how horrible it is, and the extreme right wing is talking about how horrible it is. That generally means that both extreme ends hate it. It's probably a good thing. I know, I've just probably made a bunch of enemies on both extreme ends of the parties, but that's generally what we look at. So there's emails floating around that talk about only 25% of the total funding is for infrastructure.
Well, actually, there's one that says 7%.
Oh, well, yeah. So it just depends on how you do your math and what you call infrastructure. Some people would say that broadband is not infrastructure because it's not a canal. And originally, there was this actual argument, not in email form, took place in the 1880s about railroad not being true infrastructure. That canals and ports are true infrastructure. You can't just come around and say putting these pieces of metal on the ground is infrastructure. So this is an argument that continues with every new mode of technology. That's not infrastructure. When we talk about an infrastructure bill, it's investment for the future, for future business growth, for future commerce. And that obviously includes broadband these days. And if you go to the extreme left wing, they say it does. And if you go to the extreme right wing, they say it doesn't. That generally means I'm pretty comfortable with my statement there. So those are two big pieces of news at the big macro scale. Now, what does this mean to us? Infrastructure spending over the next 5 and 10 years, additional spending on existing programs, don't expect to see the economy suddenly leap into the sky and fly higher than it did, because infrastructure takes a long time to build. Bridges need to be fixed. dams need to be reinforced, roads need to be replaced and rebuilt, broadband needs to have holes dug in very long stretches in rural areas. It's going to take us years to get this done. But this is the kind of stuff that we like to see as a reinvestment into our economy. The only individual that can do this is the government. I mean, we can reinvest at a business level and say, I'm going to put in a port for broadband. But if the broadband doesn't get to your office, it's not like you can call up the company that does broadband and say, I would like you to put in a ditch and fill it for the next 13 miles from your node point to me by myself. That would be tens of millions of dollars to get broadband to your office. So we did this for television. We did this for when television, I'm talking about cable. We did it for telephone. We did it for electricity because there are people that live far enough away that it's really not profitable for an electric company to put all the poles in, to go out all the miles to give electricity to a house that's 30 miles away from everybody else. Well, the federal government steps in and says, all right, we've got to lay that out so that we've got business opportunity everywhere. I mean, who pays for the road that goes out there? Well, the state or local or federal government does. So it's all infrastructure. Anyway, I think we've probably beaten that one up enough too. What's your next one on the list?
A little more about inflation. One of the things you can be looking forward to is the fact that anything that's made out of wheat is going to rise in price.
Yes.
It's because of the Chinese, right?
We can say that about everything now. I think that's the approved statement about all supply chain shortages is you just say, oh, it's the Chinese. Or you could fill in the blank of it's voting rights.
Well, in this case, it's a poor harvest of spring wheat.
Yeah.
And we've had some bad weather. And that causes the price of wheat to go up. And you throw in the price of transportation jumping because there's a shortage of truck drivers, and anything that's made out of wheat is going to rise in price. So get ready for that one. That's definitely transitory. So is the beef. Now, beef is up like 31% in the last quarter. I think you probably discovered that when you went to the store to buy beef, didn't you?
Nice beef. Just as a side note, Elder Baldy here got even more elder. Yesterday.
What are you saying there, Sonny?
Right. And we had a steak dinner, and the steak was a little bit of a sticker shock. Yeah. It was
not
a good steak.
Not a steak dinner at a restaurant. Right. My younger Baldy here marinated and cooked some excellent steak for me. But the point that I want to make.
So what you're saying is that the steaks have raised.
Kansas City wheat is up 40% since last November. That's a lot. That is, and that's contributing to inflation. But I wanted to come back to inflation. There are a few things, one of them's wheat, that is driving up inflation, and a lot of things that aren't driving up inflation. Jake mentioned that the lumber futures dropped from $1,600 to $600. Then one of the reasons it dropped because you can't get trusses. Can't get trusses because the plates that hold them together are in short supply. This is going to go on for a while, and I think it's important to recognize that that doesn't mean we have runaway inflation. It doesn't mean that things are going to turn terrible. It just means we're going through a transition. These transitions are where we move forward. These transitions are where new companies start up. For instance, if we realize that there's a shortage of these plates that enable us to build houses and the price is up on those, somebody's going to start building the plates because the price is up, but there's a lag between the time the price rises and the time it makes sense to build it. People weren't drilling a lot of holes in the ground to pump new oil out recently because the price of oil is low. But now we're seeing the rig count start to go up. We're seeing more drilling going on because the price is high. But it takes time, and it takes a while to stabilize. And we were stable for a long time, and we got kind of in a rut. And we've kind of been blasted out of the rut, which is a good thing because when we look back on this, we're going to see a lot of new and innovative things that took place because prices went up.
Right.
I have tremendous faith in what's going on going forward.
This is another old saying in economics. Disability drives innovation. And what we're experiencing in the supply chain issues is a disability. We had an ability to get this stuff when we wanted it. When demand went up, there's people with money that are willing to spend it to get this stuff. Therefore, the market is going to make it easy for them to get it. That's just how it works. That means the supply chain issues that we're seeing, one of the pieces of infrastructure that was in the infrastructure bill was a bunch of billions of dollars to work on the ports, to dredge them out again. We just dredged them out a few years ago to make them deeper, but the tankers and the container ships are getting bigger and bigger, and they're getting bigger faster than we're dredging. So we need to dredge more because we need more to fit on each ship. Because if you've got more on one ship, it takes less time to unload it than if you have two ships. And that's where we're going. Bigger and bigger ships. There may be an end to that at some point where we reach some size that is, you know, way big.
They've already reached it.
They've reached it in a lot of areas.
The evergreen ship that got stuck in the
right. That's an example.
In the canal.
Canal issues are going to be a thing consistently in the future.
They've stopped building ships that large because there's simply too many places in the world where they don't fit very well.
Right. You would have to only go directly across the Pacific, no canals, or go around the Horn of Africa, which increases the time. Well, that's what happened when the canal was blocked, is hundreds of ships had to go around the Horn of Africa, had to go all the way down south and come back around to go through Gibraltar to get into the Mediterranean.
I've almost come to the conclusion that any organization or institution or ship or anything else has ever at the beginning of it, I'm just going to steer away from this because Evergrande is another issue.
Yeah, Evergrande, Evergreen. Yeah.
The Chinese don't give us a lot of data about what's going on in their economy, so we have to make some guesses at it. But what we can say is there are several major real estate companies in China right now with a tremendous amount of debt who are either on the verge of or have actually collapsed. And this is one of the things that people didn't forecast very long ago. I'm certainly no way expert on China, but I can say that if there is, in fact, a domino effect real estate collapse in China, like the one we saw in the United States in 2008 and 2009. And I think it's a real possibility that will occur, by the way.
Right.
That will have a negative effect on the global economy and a negative effect on the United States, because there'd be a lot of places in China where they don't have the money to do what they need to do. And a lot of the stuff that we use to build things in the United States is actually the parts are made in China. There's potentially more bumps in the road as we move forward. The good news is,
can I throw something in on that real quick? China's manufacturing activity has contracted for the last 2 months.
Yeah.
It's shrinking. It's likely that,
Wait a minute. This is an economic show about economics. It's negative growth.
Negative growth. Yes. We have negative growth. Somehow that's more acceptable in conversations in economics, even though any kid that listens to negative growth, what are you talking about? We have a word for that. Anyway, they've experienced this contraction for 2 months now in a row, that they are producing less. They are manufacturing less because they're having these shutdowns. At the same time that they're experiencing this pretty nasty debt issue across the real estate sectors and massive government crackdowns and seizures of assets, it's now illegal to mine or own Bitcoin in China, where the majority of Bitcoins are owned.
Are you aware that it's illegal to use the term, it just became illegal in China to use the term tennis in an email message?
Tennis?
Yes, tennis.
Whoa.
It was a tennis star who criticized Chairman Xi.
Okay. So what we're seeing there is
they are now saying if you send an email message out with the word tennis in it, it will get blotted out and you may get a visit.
Yeah. So what we're saying here is, go ahead.
The other thing that's illegal to use an email in China as of about a week ago is Winnie the Pooh.
Was it used as a political statement about somebody?
It was finally whoever it is that the email censors are realized that Winnie the Pooh was Chairman Xi.
People were using him to represent Xi.
They were saying Winnie the Pooh when they were criticizing Chairman Xi. It sounded like they were criticizing Winnie the Pooh. So why do I bring this up? Because in an authoritarian, I'll get the word right here, government, innovation dies. And the Chinese are depending on innovation to catch up with us. And I think they have just slit their own throat or shot their own foot, if you will. Anyway,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and that whole concept, the manufacturing in China slowing down right in the middle of a supply chain shortage. This is part of the reason why we're getting the supply chain issue, is that the manufacturing place that we thought of as never-ending supply, just as a side note, our balance of trade, our deficit of trade with the rest of the world is at an absolute record high. We are buying a lot more from them than we're selling to them. Unless you count dollars that we're sending out, because that's a manufactured commodity as well. The Chinese are in a massive surplus of trade situation, but their manufacturing is falling off, and their economy is likely experiencing the worst growth that it's had in the last 40 years. All of this is going on while the government is clamping down hard. And the United States is bringing back as much of its supply chain issues to itself, not as a government. That would be like a move that the Chinese government would do and say, hey, we're going to direct all our companies to do this. We only do that in extreme situations, like when a law has been passed by Congress to say we're going to direct all companies to make sure that they wear hard hats while banging their heads with hammers, that sort of thing. In China, they don't need Congress to do anything. The dictator dictates, and that's the law. All of that is to point at some things I kind of wanted to concentrate down to the personal financial planning side. We're watching the savings rate. If at any time in my career, if I had seen a savings rate in the United States of 9%, I would say, oh my goodness, all my wishes have come true. People have suddenly turned around and seen the errors of the ways, and they're going to be saving. This is a drop from what it was a year ago. What was it, up to 16%? Was the savings?
I think it touched 16, but it stabilized at about 14 for a while.
Right. So 14% of people's income was going into their bank account across the United States because people were scared. We're now down to 9%, but a traditional rate is a negative number. For the last several decades, we flirt a lot more with a negative savings rate, which is to say people have nothing in their bank and they have overdraft going and their credit cards are getting bigger. To the other way around, where we've been paying credit cards down and we've got savings at a rate that's just phenomenal, you that are listening to us right now, you're probably a good representation of that. You probably have more in savings and less in credit card than you did 3 years ago. I can say that with some confidence because it's really unlikely that you would leave this program going and be interested in it if you hadn't already done that. People that listen to this program generally are doing it because they want to improve their financial well-being. Those are habits that you make. So what we would say to you is continue to keep your savings at a good rate. Continue not to use your credit cards. Continue to invest for your future in a well-diversified portfolio. Those are all good things that we can take from this moment in bad, bad times to say, if you maintain these habits, it's really hard to say that that's going to be bad for you. It's really easy to say that's going to be good for you. So that's something I think it's maybe the most important thing that we're telling you in this 2 hour period. We've talked about all these big macro things and talking about supply chain issues and inflation and who's going to be chairman of the Federal Reserve and infrastructure bills. And the reality is that right now, the habits in the United States around finances are in the process of making a major, major shift, as big a shift as what China's going through in the authoritarian side. We're going through on the self-responsibility side. And as much as we hear about the government handouts and the stimulus, if everybody was just expecting that, oh yeah, we don't have to worry, we're going to get a stimulus check. Oh, we don't have to worry. We wouldn't see a 9% savings rate. So the habits that you're developing right now, on average, are being developed by everyone. It's just a question of how long you're going to keep those habits. And whether or not you're going to change in a year or two, when you start to forget the fear of the pandemic, and you start saying, I don't need all that money in my bank account. I'll just spend it all and get some more credit cards. I think we've seen a big shift, and it's kind of like what happened to the people that lived through the Depression. It changed the way they thought about money. And for some of them, it changed it for the good, and some of them, it changed it for the bad. Like, there were a whole bunch of people that just stopped trusting banks in general during the Depression because a lot of banks failed, and so they never wanted to go to a bank. We don't have that. We maybe we trust the banks too much at this point, because the number of people that I've talked to in the past month that have been saving, and they are higher income people, they're not people that would have like tens of millions of dollars, but it's a dual earning couple. They're both professionals. They're making money and they haven't been going on vacation. And I ask them how much money they have in the bank, and they say, well, we have $380,000 in the bank. And we say, wow, that's amazing. Well done. What are you doing? Is that all in one bank? And they say, oh yeah, it's in one bank. And I say, well, that's more than the FDIC covers. So why don't you take some of that money from that bank and put it in another bank? People trust.
It's per account, $250,000 per account.
Per registration.
Yes.
Per owner. So if you, and let me kind of get into this a little bit specific. If John Doe has an account in his name, say he's got five accounts at the same bank, and each of those accounts has $50,000 in it, he's covered. Because he's got a total in the bank in his name alone of $250,000. If he has more than that, even in another account at the same bank, it's not covered. Unless he shares the registration like a joint account. If it's John and Jane Doe, they get a separate $250,000. And then Jane Doe has her own $250,000. So when you look at the coverage on this, you can situate your bank accounts, if you're willing to have a joint account in there, to get more coverage at the FDIC. Let's give the email addresses out one more time. If you have a question for us that you'd like us to answer, we've got only about 15 minutes left in the hour. The email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or The Personal Wealth Coach. And we're going to play some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. And this is Jake McClure on the line with me.
Jeff McClure.
All right. And you have something you want to say.
There's another number out there that is an example of when you see a number that looks like it's bad, and you dig down into the depth of it, and it turns out to be good.
And vice versa sometimes.
Yeah. The U.S. trade deficit hit a fresh record this month, this last quarter, and this last month. It's was up a bunch. And it's the highest it's ever been. And the first reaction, I think we have in June of 2021, it was $73.23 billion. September 21, it was $80.93 billion. So it's up. And the initial reaction was...
Can I jump in there and just say what we were talking about? The balance of trade is when what we sell as companies that are based inside the borders of the United States and manufacturing inside the borders of the United States. How much did we import? How much did we export outside the borders and then into the borders? And we have a negative. So we imported into the borders more than we exported. There's problems with those numbers lots of times in that a lot of times, like Ford is an American company that's manufacturing in Mexico and in Canada using parts made inside the borders of the United States. So what's the import and what's the export there? So there's some problems with the GDP, but it's a good number to look at because it's been
GDP
consistently done. And then the GDP results with the balance of trade at the end of it. So the balance of trade is a GDP number that comes out that says, here's where our trade is. It has a direct result in the GDP calculation. So go ahead.
What I wanted to say was the trade deficit is a good thing. First off, we can get into that, and we have in the past. There really is no trade deficit. We export as much as we import. We have to. We've been doing it. We theoretically have had a huge trade deficit for 40 years. It was going to hurt us. We'd be the weakest economy in the world. It would have blown up. Instead, we're the strongest. And we can, if somebody wants to argue with that, I can certainly spend some time on it and show you. But that's beside the point.
The vast majority of our economy is not imported. It's not exported. It's here. That's what we talk about in a consumer-based economy.
There's been a shift, and we're seeing the results of the shift. Earlier, the stuff that was coming in the United States was mainly consumer goods. We had a lot of money. We were in lockdown, and we spent a lot of money on things, on stuff. That's the economic term for that.
Yes,
we spent a lot of money on stuff, and a lot of it's manufactured outside the United States. And almost, I bought some stuff recently and got some stuff for my birthday, and I was looking at it, and I yet to find anything that was manufactured in the United States.
You got two gifts yesterday that were absolutely manufactured. One of them was manufactured by a tree inside the United States, and one was manufactured before there was a United States, but in the same general
location. That was an import into the United States because obviously the United States was...
No, the United States anyway, was imported into the continent after that rock was made. So he got gifts.
What Jake is trying to say is his two small children gave me presents yesterday for my birthday. One of them gave me a pine cone and the other one gave me a rock, and I thought that was cool.
Yes.
But let's...
Those were not imported. That's all I'm saying.
What I want to get to here, if I can get to it,
please,
is the imports have shifted in recent months. Consumer goods have sagged. We're seeing a reduction in imports of consumer goods. Apparel's dropped 2.1%. compared with where they were in 2020. Meanwhile, here's where the demand is, and here's stuff that's being imported. The imports of iron and steel were up 93% in the first 9 months of 2021 compared with last year. Wood imports rose 79%. What does that mean? We are building things in the United States, and we're importing things to add value to them in the United States. So when you import wood or steel, and you build something out of it to sell, the thing you built out of it to sell is worth a lot more than the raw wood or the steel.
Right. We're not importing the completed things anymore. We're importing ingredients for the completed things.
This indicates what you'll see, and this is part of the fact, we were talking about the fact that productivity dropped because we're hiring a lot of people. This is all tied together. We're importing a lot of stuff to build things that are far more expensive, some of which will get exported, by the way.
Right.
You don't import a lot of steel unless you got something to build with it. Car companies are not importing steel if they don't think they're going to get the chips to build the cars.
Correct.
So this is one of those cases where this record trade imbalance, if you dig down into it, it's a tremendous piece of good news. It means that the United States economy is revving up and we need more raw materials to build things with so that we can sell them. And that is a very, very healthy condition. And again, there is no real trade imbalance, and we can go in, it'd take about half a show to explain that. We right. manufacture something and export it that doesn't get counted in the exports, and it is literally our most valuable export by a long shot. And we only got 5 minutes left in this hour, so we don't have time to get into that too much. But it's there. And it's just, there's an assumption in the trade deficit. There's an assumption in the GDP. There's a lot of assumptions out there that we're still on the gold standard, which we aren't, thank God. We are on a completely different standard. Money is completely different from what we intuitively think it is. And as a result, the growth in the United States is wonderful. And we're doing some wonderful stuff. And I guess we can move on to the next subject. Oh, yeah. 401k contributions. If you're one of those people who has a 401k and you like to max it out, your new maximum 401k contribution is $20,500.
With a step up, if you're above 50 years old, do you know what the step up is? I think it's 401k. Catch up.
Well, contribution. IRAs.
Catch up contribution.
IRAs remain the same, $6,000 and $6,500 in catch up.
Yeah. The $6,500 catch up is on the 401ks. Yeah. So it's $1,000 catch up on the.
I think the $20,500 is just a flat maximum, no matter how old you are, on a 401k. And I may be wrong, but I think
that's not right. Okay. That's not right. It is $20,500. The IRS announced on November 4th, top off at $20,500. Plan participants age 50 or older next year can contribute an additional $6,500.
Oh, okay.
So for them, it's $27,000 that they can max contribute to. And at the same time, when we're talking about all this inflation, we didn't raise the cap on how much you could put into your IRAs. It's still $6,000 and a catch-up of $1,000. So what can you take out of this? After all of the stuff that we've talked about, possible inflation going on and Federal Reserve issues, comes back to what we said earlier. It's the same thing that we said pre-pandemic. It's the same thing that we said 10 years ago. It's the same thing we said 20 years ago. This is stuff that doesn't change. First priority is to get your savings in cash, in the bank, in a comfortable place to cover your near-term emergencies. Make sure that you're living within your means and not overfilling your credit cards. And then start allocating money to your future. Get well diversified. If you have enough money that you're having difficulty figuring out where to do that and how to do that, seek some fiduciary help. We are prejudiced. We're fiduciaries. That's how we do make our living. But we tend to think that, what does fiduciary mean? It means somebody that's put you way ahead of themselves, that you are first interest, if not sole interest, in the conversation. And that needs to come in writing. Then get well diversified, figure out what you're trying to accomplish, and that's where you're going. And we're about out of time. Unfortunately, we had to disconnect with Jeff because the connection was so bad. But if you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have locally available, there's a voicemail during the weekend, real live people during the week at 947-254-947-1111. Or you can reach that same voicemail on the weekend, real live people during the week, at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can sign up for our newsletter there, read our past newsletters. You can listen to our radio program going back lots of years. You can listen to a podcast of our program wherever you look for podcasts. We're in all the major providers. You can also email us directly or contact us through the form. The emails are jeff at tpwc.com or jeff at tpwc.com.